online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Unfortunately, no one's got the crystal ball to understand when this might alleviate. And as I said before, drier conditions mean that, you know, producers are, again, that they're proactively trying to make decisions about which stock to turn off.
Farmers under pressure as mutton markets crash. And a Queensland grazing couple has broken the record for the largest allocation of Australian carbon credits, creating a solid income stream.
We didn't go into it chasing a huge amount of carbon credits, but the research in these projects has shown that it's possible, and across a trying five-year period.
Hello there, happy Wednesday, and later in the program we'll cross to Campbelltown, where about 70 school children are involved in the Tasmanian Merino Weather Challenge. I look forward to finding out how they're all going. And of course, we'll finish off with Richard Bailey with the Livestock Report. So stay with us right through till 1 o'clock. And if you'd like to join the conversation, send us a text 0438 922 936. But first, mutton markets have crashed to their lowest levels in 16 years, with the national indicator falling below 100 cents per kilogram's carcass weight. It comes as members of Sheep Producers Australia held a crisis meeting on Friday to discuss what could possibly be done to alleviate the situation. Sheep Producers Chief Executive Bonnie Skinner says farmers need support.
I think the biggest request and call for action was around, first and foremost, to understand what support producers need and to how to connect producers with that level of support. So there was certainly a lot of discussion around what resources are available on the ground to help producers or support their decision making at this period in time. So there was significant discussion around that. There was certainly a lot of discussion around what opportunities might exist to support some congestion busting type activities. There was a lot of discussion around, labour and processing capacity in our plants and where that situation is up to and what could be done to alleviate that, which we know has been a problem for the last, 18 months or more. So a lot of discussion there, a lot of calls for advocacy, certainly to federal government to help them understand what's happening in the sheep industry at the moment. So a lot of recognition that there's not a lot of levers that could be pulled in the immediate sense to relieve the situation, but certainly a lot of discussion about what needs to be done to support producers.
Are people somewhat in a state of shock that things have become so bad so quickly?
I think there's a real mix of views out there in the moment. There are certainly a number of producers that I'm in discussion with and points of view that were relayed in the meeting as well around how quickly this seems to have been occurring, particularly with some classes of livestock. But a lot of other producers are also being quite pragmatic about the fact that markets, they go up and they go down, and it's about managing in and through and out the other side. So I think where there have been a number of factors that are increasingly out of people's control when they're trying to manage their business and manage their everyday risk on their properties, the prospect of dry conditions has really sent a lot of people into feeling very overwhelmed and needing to start thinking about making decisions much more quickly, which is, obviously prompting people to look at how they can get some numbers off their property.
And if we look at the mutton price particularly, as we speak, the mutton indicator, it's fallen below 100 cents a kilogram carcass weight for the first time in 16 years. That equates to an average price of $29 a head for sheep being sold at the sale yards. It's pretty grim.
Yeah, certainly everyone's had an eye on the mutton prices for the last little while, watching how they've been in decline. And certainly, ultimately softened demand, particularly from the processors around mutton, whether that's in our export markets, but we're obviously aware of the bottleneck that exists as well and the processing capacity as well. It is an unusual mix of circumstances in terms of, comparing it to a previous drought and where we've seen prices sit prior to that. And unfortunately, no one's got the crystal ball to understand when this might alleviate. And as I said before, drier conditions mean that, you know, producers are, again, that they're proactively trying to make decisions about which stock to turn off. And so we're going to see more mutton coming onto the market, which, you know, is likely to mean that prices are not going to get any better in the short term. So it certainly is a concerning situation, and it's the topic of a lot of discussion around industry at the moment.
I'm sure the looming live export ban came up on Friday. What's the sentiment around that, and how it could be contributing to negativity in the industry that could be fueling lower prices?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and it's certainly, you know, WA is a unique case for what it's experiencing in terms of the prospects of LiveX being phased out. We've been watching confidence levels there throughout the year as these discussions have been taking place and following the government's announcement. Certainly confidence there has been very, very low. We've seen a drop in confidence across the board in Australia as well. I think it's, you know, for government, a big part of our topic of our discussions with them is around the impact that policy making, the decisions that creates in terms of people's confidence to continue to invest in their farms and on their businesses. People need certainty, and at the moment, certainly that it just seems to be one hit after the other, particularly for producers in the West. It's part of the reason why there's been such discussion around the Qatar Airlines decision. It seems to be another decision that's been made by government that isn't taking into account that producers and the lamb industry, the sheep meat industry, need as many market opportunities as possible, particularly to take advantage of some of the fantastic trade outcomes that we've had in the more recent times. So certainly these things are impacting on confidence, and that's why it's so important that people are talking to each other and reaching out to get the support that they need so that they are looking after themselves.
That was Bonnie Skinner, Chief Executive of Sheep Producers Australia, speaking with Angus Verley. A Queensland grazing couple has broken the record for the largest allocation of Australian carbon credit units awarded to an individual soil carbon project. Carly and Grant Burnham started transitioning their 5,200 hectare property to regenerative practices in 2016 by subdividing paddocks, shortening grazing periods and adding more water points. It means their beef is now carbon negative. For every tonne of livestock carried, 6.6 tonnes of carbon is sequestered, even in tough years. It's generated almost 95,000 ACCUs. But Grant says it's business as usual on the farm.
We didn't go into it chasing a huge amount of carbon credits, but the research in these projects has shown that it's possible, and across a trying 5-year period. So we got the second measurements done in 2021, and we were able to sequester a fair amount of carbon deep into the landscape. Yeah, and some of those years were quite dry. We had sort of 3 out of 5 of those years that were trying. As far as drought situations, we got a few other challenges such as dieback, pasture dieback, in which a lot of people in the central Queensland area are experiencing. And other projects who we worked alongside of had also had bushfires and other challenges also. So it's shown that good grazing management practices can really help, you know, increase the resilience of any business. So, yeah, going on from now with the carbon being sequestered and ACCUs being generated, well, it's going to be an interesting space, how we move forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, at a time when the broader meat and livestock industry is reassessing its own carbon neutrality targets, you're not carbon neutral, you're carbon negative. What does that mean?
Yeah, it just means that livestock can play a huge part in this whole dilemma that we find ourselves in for so long, raising livestock. And you know, ruminants have been blamed and part of the issue with emissions. So now to see that under a good grazing management and planned grazing situations, it can be a huge part of the solution. It's a real, really exciting thing for agriculture. I think it's great. And yeah, looking forward to working with people to hopefully help it on a broader scale.
And what kind of performance have you seen in the cattle through these changes over the years?
Overall, it's been been a positive impact on the outcomes of our beef production system. You know, sometimes when you're changing grazing management into most operations, you might see some negative impacts on cattle performance, but overall we've been able to run a lot more livestock on the same amount of land with, you know, average or less than average rainfall events, but it still means that we've got to adjust our stocking rates and carrying capacities through those tough years. That's the main focus, you know, just look at the health of the land more so than how many cattle you can run. Our main focus is to give back to the land more than we take each year. So we're increasing that natural capital of the landscape. Yeah, I think, you know, carbon's only one part of a much bigger process in looking after the health of and natural capital. Like it's now seen that it's a measurable component, one of a very important component of natural capital. And yeah, just being able to measure that and seeing that increase, that's the most important part for us.
And now that you've got those ACCUs, what will you do with them?
It's been a long wait getting to this point. So we haven't really put a lot of focus on what we're going to do with them, but we're looking to partner with people that have equally aligned values as us with the environment. I think there's a lot of opportunities to come out, whether it be you're relinquishing some of them for certain parts of our business and opening better marketing opportunities. Yeah, we're certainly exploring a lot of options at the moment, but looking to partner with people with similar values to ours.
Do you think that will go some way to helping inform people in the cities and consumers about what the actual impact on the environment is from these kinds of operations?
Yeah, well, I think we're in a really blessed position to be food producers and land custodians. So the opportunity to connect the end consumer with the producer here and providing beautiful, healthy food from a healthy environment and having consumers eat that produce, knowing that they're contributing to the improvement of an environment. I think there's been so much negative news about food being negative on the environment, but this is an opportunity to turn that right around. So, I just love the opportunity to be connected to the consumer on multiple levels. The decisions that they're making at the shop or online or, you know, however they purchase their beef and produce is actually helping make a difference to our environment.
And that was Grant Burnham from Bonnie Doon at Monto, 500 kilometres north of Brisbane, speaking to Callie Buchanan. And yesterday afternoon, the ACCU generic spot price was $30.75. That puts the value of his units at just over $2.8 million. Quite a pretty penny.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
A new landcare group has been set up to protect a patch of bushland at Deloraine. The area known as Wildwood on the banks of the Meander River is owned by the Meander Valley Council and is much loved by locals. Larissa Smith spoke to the group's president, Peter Hansen, about plans to improve it.
You know, as you walk towards the end of the caravan park, you come across a causeway, which is one of the little creeks that comes into the Meander River. And then if you follow the river up, which the track does, you know, there's mainly silver wattles and sycamore forest, which is an invasive species. So that goes right up to the end to another river creek junction where there's some myrtles, and that's, you know, myrtles and ferns. And if you continue along the path, it sort of circles back and goes across some grasslands where there's bandicoots and wallabies, you know, the little Bennett wallabies, lots of birds. On your right, as you keep on walking around the circuit, there's an area that used to be the old river that's somewhat you know, swampy now. It's got some water in it, but it's mainly swamp. But there's quite often frogs, you know, the different species. Like, I've recorded quite a few different recordings there, and they're all different. All along the river there, there's platypus. That's one of our issues, is we want to maintain the habitat for the platypus, but that involves, you know, willow removal or at some time, you know. But the main issue is controlling the invasive species. It's a floodplain, so we've got to try and figure out how to work that into our plantings and our mulching and all that sort of thing. So it's a beautiful place to walk, and a lot of people do use it every day.
What's the relationship between the group then and council? How do you think you'll work together here?
Well, it's going very well so far. We've developed a strategy, and a couple of, you know, quite a few of very talented people have contributed. Like, we've got this brilliant discussion document that was written by one of the guys that was part of the group, Paddy Murray, and originally, you know, one of our forester people, John Tabor, has developed a zone map. It's a very complex environment, and it helps us actually think through how we're going to work on each of the areas. So he's zoned off an area, you know, like the grasslands. He's zoned off another area that's got eucalypts in it, sort of a eucalypt spine that goes through the middle in the swamp. So, and that's how we've developed our strategy. So, you know, how we can work on each zone to maintain or, you know, stop the invasive species from killing the eucalypts, for example. You know, the most delicate part is along the river. You know, there's willows, there's sycamores, and we've got to run a few experiments and trials to figure out how to best maintain that and not disturb any of the animal habitat.
And that's a challenge too, because willows and sycamores are invasive species, I guess. If you remove them, you can lead to bank erosion and collapse into the river itself. All of that might be habitat for the platypus. So it's a delicate balance, isn't it?
It is, and we can't get it wrong. We are talking to lots of experts, and, you know, I suppose the main thing is we can't just take the willows out and just hope for the best. We have to have a contingency there to work through how best to do that. You know, we've got lots of help. Everybody is very keen to help. We haven't got a knockback yet. You know, there's lots of people that we've asked for assistance. You know, the committee's really one of the most dynamic I've ever had anything to do with. It's just amazing.
Personally, you've had a connection to the environment in a lot of places that you've lived in over the years. You're not a local Tasmanian.
Well, I was brought up in southeast Queensland, and I worked in Queenstown for a while, and then I went back to southeast Queensland, and I built, with the help of a lot of other people, a permaculture park on council land in Ipswich, and it's been very successful. Like, it's still there. Purist permaculturalists would not agree that it was a permaculture environment anymore, but there's lots of beautiful, unusual trees there. Like, there's lychees and carob and jabodicaba that probably tropical people familiar with tropical plants would know. And I've also worked in the Wallen area around Melbourne, planting trees with the environmental group there. So, yeah, everywhere I've lived, I've had some involvement in some environmental groups. You know, we're currently working through it depends whether it's going to be a memorandum of understanding some sort of license arrangement between us and the council, or the public and the council. And that's got to happen before we can actually physically start work, because, you know, we won't be insured. So a lot's happened, but a few more things have to happen before we can actually start work, which hopefully will be in the next month.
And that was Peter Hanson, president of the newly formed Wildwood Landcare Group at Deloraine. When you think of farming, you probably aren't thinking of customers sharing the risks and rewards of what's being grown to feed them. But that's exactly how Echo Valley Farm in Queensland's Southern Downs operates, with people signing up to support a farm through thick and thin. It's called community-supported agriculture. Jennifer Nichols spoke to first-generation farmer Randall Breen, who started his multi-species regenerative farm with his wife Juanita in 2014. It's just west of the Great Dividing Range in the Goombarra Valley.
Our core focus is about building soil health and healing landscape, so trying to really deeply connect to our landscape and listen to the cues that that landscape is telling us, so what it needs and what it's trying to achieve, which sounds a little woo-woo, but just observing the landscape and then utilising animals and practices to help to heal it. So that might be something that might be considered a weed by conventional mindset. We can see as an indicator a plant that's trying to heal the soil. And so we use cows, chooks and pigs at this current moment to work with us symbiotically to heal the soil, so moving everything constantly. So we call it nomadic agriculture, so moving them across the landscape from daily to weekly, regularly shifting to help heal the soil.
Sounds quite labour intensive.
Yeah, it definitely is. That's probably one of the most challenging aspects of this farming model, is that it takes a lot of labour. And so that's one of the challenges. But yeah, it's a labour of love.
And how much land do you have?
So we span across two properties. In total, it's 650 acres.
So there's a fair bit to work with there.
Yeah, there's a fair bit of country. It's a really interesting mix of previously conventionally farmed land, about 50-50 between that and remnant vegetation. So it's a very undulating farms, moving from quite high basalt ridges down onto creek flats. Probably the areas that need the most regenerating is the previously farmed land. It was quite over-farmed in its life, 120 years of conventional agriculture.
What have you seen as results of your labour in terms of the land?
I think the critical thing has been the increase in diversity. So once we shift our mindset away from trying to stop things from growing, be that weeds or things that we don't desire, and we actually let all things grow, we start to build diversity. And the reason we want diversity is that diversity builds resilience. So if we are only running a single species of plant, be that a monocultured crop or one species of grass, we're only one catastrophic event away from having nothing. Having a desert, essentially. So what we've done is, over the almost 10 years of us being in this location, is that we're starting to see more and more diversity of species of plants, which is building resilience into our system.
And how does your property look compared to the neighbouring ones?
We get comments from our neighbours saying, geez, your place greens up really quickly after rain. I think that's probably the critical thing, is because we're trying to build hydration through the growing of multiple species of plants so that we retain every drop of moisture that falls on the soil.
What sort of water sources do you have?
From the sky. We don't have any creeks or anything on our property, but underground water in our area is really, really good.
And so how many animals have you got, and how does your business work?
Cool. Yeah, good questions. Animal numbers is a constantly changing thing. So we're constantly trying to balance mouths to feed availability in our landscape. So at the moment, as we're starting to dry out, we're seeing an El Nino coming on, and we've definitely noticed a drying of our landscape. So we're actually at the moment in the process of moving animals on, either into an adjustment or selling animals in order to reduce the number of mouths that need to be fed on our landscape, to try to balance that with how much grass we're growing and how quickly it grows. From that, we're producing eggs, pork and beef. And so those products we direct market and work with customers to grow a whole range of different products that we then feed our customers. We call it a CSA model, so that's community supported agriculture. And so the concept is that our customers actually become partners in our farm, essentially. They sign up as a member, generally for 12 months, but we've got members who have been part of our CSA program since we started in 2014. And so what happens is, this is about the people that we feed sharing in both the risk and the reward of producing food. So if we have a really tough year, so 2019 was a really rough year for us in a drought, our members actually chose to reduce how much food we were giving them, but continue to pay the same amount. And as a result, that enabled us to retain animals on our landscape so that we could start again when the rains came, which is just quite amazing. And then the other extreme is, when we have seasons of abundance, when we're producing excess, they get to share in that reward as well.
And you've actually been building something pretty exciting on the farm.
Yeah, so the latest thing over the last, it's taken about 2.5 years, but the last 12 months significantly has been developing an on-farm boning and packing room. And so that's about trying to take back control in what happens with our products and trying to honour the whole animal in the production of food. And what's been beautiful is that we've done that in partnership with our CSA members. We had a crowdfunding campaign and managed to raise the funds to actually build that building. So it's quite amazing when you you build that relationship around your food system, people stand up and step up to the challenge of trying to make it work.
You must have made some pretty special friendships over that time then.
Yeah, absolutely. Just quite remarkable connections with people. Just thinking of a young guy called Connor, who's only 9 years old, and he came out with his family to plant trees on our farm. So that's one of the things we do with our CSA members. They come to the farm regularly, help us with all manner of different things. And he came out to plant trees. He wasn't really keen on the idea initially. Anyway, he spent the day with us sticking trees in the ground and talking about why this is important and how some of our heavily over-farmed land that we're trying to regenerate needs trees back in the landscape and all that sort of thing. And anyway, his mother sent us a message on the way home because he said, "Oh, Mum, I think I get it now. We help the farmers because they produce our food." And so I think those deep relationships is just such a special way to be engaged in food production.
It must be tough at times, though.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's a challenging career or a challenging vocation to choose, but I think the benefits far outweigh the challenges.
Randall Breen from Echo Valley Farm. Time for the news headlines with Early Ward.
Thanks, Fiona. The Tasmanian government is yet to give a new timeline for the closure of the state's only youth detention facility after the Commission of Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse recommended it be shut immediately. The government had promised to close Ashley by the end of next year after decades of scathing reports and allegations of abuse. Premier Jeremy Rockliffe says the process of setting up five facilities to replace it and creating a therapeutic model to underpin them will take time, and it's unlikely to meet that time frame. The latest mortality data has found that COVID-19 was the third leading cause of death in Australia in 2022. The preliminary data published by the Bureau of Statistics shows the virus was the primary cause of death for just under 10,000 people. It's the first time an infectious disease has been in the top five leading causes of death since 1970. And Qatar Airways says it's committed to ensuring women are never subjected to invasive searches again. In October 2020, a number of women at Doha Airport were taken off a Qatar plane and forced to undergo bodily and vaginal examinations without their consent after a newborn baby was found abandoned. At a Senate inquiry, Qatar insists it won't happen again. More news at 1.
Thank you, Early. Let's check the latest from the Weather Bureau now. Alex Malitzis joins us. Good afternoon, Alex.
G'day, Fiona.
What's been happening? Much rainfall overnight?
No, we haven't seen any significant rainfall overnight or since 9 a.m. this morning. We're in a pretty dry period and we've got some fairly warm west to northwesterly winds over us. That's starting to bring the odd little light shower into parts of the west and the northwest as we speak. I can see some showers in that area on the radar, but generally for the rest of today we are looking at less than a millimetre or two across the west, and it should be dry elsewhere. Looking further ahead, tonight we'll see a little cold front across the state, and then tomorrow we're back into the sort of westerly regime, so we will see just the odd little light shower or two continue about the west and far south tomorrow, but it should be dry elsewhere. Temperatures warming a little bit tomorrow, so there'll be a few degrees above average tomorrow. Then continuing to the end of the week, on Friday we see another cold front cross in the morning, and that'll bring showers to the west and far and the west and south. We're looking at generally less than 5 millimetres of rainfall across those parts on Friday, and then we'll see a ridge move over Friday afternoon, so the weather settling down later on Friday. And then the warming continues on the weekend with those warm west to northwesterly winds sort of continuing. So really the main story is just some light showers into the west and far south over the coming few days, and a warming trend with temperatures quite a bit above average for this time of year over the coming weekend and into next week. And look, just quickly, some listeners may note that the European model is suggesting some pretty heavy rainfall across the east coast later next week as a big low develops to the over the Tasman Sea, and we're watching that one. But at this stage, it looks like heavy rainfall into the east late next week is probably a low probability scenario, with the most likely scenario being that the rain stays a bit further east offshore.
So that's
just one thing to watch.
Yeah, that's coming across on international modelling or something.
That's right. So there's lots. We basically look at around sort of 60 or 70 models, and the most popular European one is suggesting a scenario, but it's very low predictability with that one. So nice to watch, but at this stage, the most likely scenario is that the rain is not going to really get too much into the east.
Okay. Any warnings at all?
Yes, there's a bit of wind around later on today and tomorrow. So if you're going boating today, there's a gale wind warning out for southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point. Also a strong wind warning for northeastern coastal waters and for the lower east coast, central west coast and the southwest lakes today. And tomorrow there's a gale wind warning out for southern coastal waters. There's also a strong wind warning out for northern coastal waters tomorrow from Stanley Point to St Helens Point. And for the central west coast, the Channel and the southwest lakes tomorrow. And look, winds tomorrow, we're generally looking at west to northwesterly winds of around 20 to 30 knots, reaching 35 knots in the south, but the winds are expected to be a little bit lighter in the east tomorrow, generally around 10 to 20 knots. Swell tomorrow in the west and south, we're looking at a west to southwesterly swell of around 3.5 to 4.5 metres. In the north tomorrow, a westerly swell of around 1 metre. And in the east, a south to southeasterly swell of around 1 to 1.5 metres, reaching 2.5 metres offshore in the south. And currently, the Cape Sorrel wave rider buoy in the west is sitting on around 2 metres, and that's a southwesterly with a period of around 8 seconds. And in the east, the Maria Island buoy is sitting on around 1.2 metres, and that's a south to southwesterly with a period of around 7 seconds.
Fantastic. Alex Militsis, thanks very much. We'll catch you again tomorrow.
Thanks, Fiona. Bye.
If your pillow is wet because your Persian has peed there or your ragdoll's been using its claws on your lounge chair, if your anxious Maine Coon won't poop till it's popping, if you're adopting a kitten or buying a cat or adjusting your Burmese to a one-bedroom flat, if your pretty little kitty is causing a catastrophe, perhaps you should call us on Weekend Cat Talker. I'm Mel Bush. Join me and cat expert Andrea Khan as we try to perfect your feline problems. Saturday morning at 10 from ABC Radio Hobart.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, the mining industry is one that's known to be heavily dominated by men. But a New South Wales-based metallurgist wants to see more effort to encourage women and girls to consider a career in mining. In Australia, it's estimated just 16% of the workforce in the industry is female. And Bianca Newcomb wants to see that change. After growing up in Brisbane and spending years in Kalgoorlie, she recently received an award as an exceptional woman in Australian resources. Ms. Newcomb spoke to Tim Fuchs about the challenges facing women in mining and why schools need to be the starting point to get more women involved.
It can be challenging. So for women particularly, the biggest challenge is probably isolation. So I have worked in some fairly remote places and it can be an issue for you know, mental health reasons and just the access to general services. You know, I mean, you're aware of all the problems that rural towns would have, and yet they're all there in mining because mines aren't in the city. So that's challenging. It has gotten better over the years. So I mean, I've 25 years I've been in industry. So when I first started, it was pretty normal that I would be the only professional woman in a meeting on site. So it's gotten better. There are more women. They've improved facilities and services, and there's a lot of company programs and things now that just didn't exist when I first started.
But it's still an industry you think of when you think of mining. It's still heavily, heavily dominated by men.
And it is. And that, if BHP hit a 50% female-male ratio, there'd be no women left for anybody else, right? Just because there's not enough women coming through the universities qualified in the engineering STEM sort of disciplines, geosciences, to fill all those roles.
So what needs to happen to change that?
We have to get them interested in high school. That would be the first step. And even then, it's possibly too late because the interest needs to start in primary. These girls, I've got three daughters, two of them are in high school. They already know what they want to do, you know, in grade nine, and they don't want to work in mining. So. And none of their friends do either. Like, they're not in any of the STEM disciplines. And it's a problem. And sometimes I think that we run the potential of actually losing the ground that we've gained because we're not, I don't know, there's some sort of disconnect happening with how we try and get the girls interested in maths and, you know, chemistry and physics and these type of things.
So. Has there been much effort to try and encourage, I guess, girls / women at a young age to get into the industry?
There are programs around, but they're not necessarily tailored towards girls. Mm. So, I mean, we had a New South Wales mining event for high school in Orange probably a couple of months ago now, but there was mostly boys, you know, and they want to do trades, which is fine. Like, kudos to them, you know, that's fine. But, yeah, there just was not that many girls there. And they had some speakers there, some of the graduates, like from, there was a graduate from Cadia, female managers standing up. But they're not sort of talking to the right audience. And so you need to be able to somehow, and I don't know what the solution is, but there's something that needs to be done to show young girls that this is actually an option and they don't need to be afraid of it.
And saying that, what's your experience been like? I mean, what's the attraction to try and say to people, young people, that this is a good industry to be involved in?
There's so many opportunities. So there is this perception about mining that it's all, you know, big trucks blowing things up and it's all dirty. But that's kind of like an old perception. And they're not really advertising very well that actually now we've got all this AI coming into, you know, processing facilities, robotics running trains and all this other stuff is happening. That's really actually quite cool when you think about it. Mm. And there's so much more going on than what the perception is. So, again, I don't have the solution for it.
But it's an important issue to put out there.
Yeah.
And you were talking about the isolation and what it was like when you were early on in your career. And how much has it improved now in regards to the support available for people out in the middle of nowhere?
So on remote sites, there are just generally more women there than there used to be, which is a good thing. And I think the companies have the strategies in place to deal with things when they happen. So that's a big improvement. When I was quite young, if something happened, you basically just left the job. Like, yeah, that's just what happened.
Mm.
So, which is a shame, but, you know, and if you're a woman and your reporting structure on site is through men, you know, maybe you don't actually want to report it either and you've got to try and deal with it yourself.
You were talking about artificial intelligence and technology. You'd have seen such an enormous change over the years, but what's the indication of where it's going and what it's going to mean for roles like yours and those working in the mining industry?
So there's certain aspects of what happens on mines that can be easily sort of automated, but there's other things that require more intuition and like a long time of gained knowledge about what to do if you see a certain mineral. And I'm not sure how they would train an AI to recognize, you know, if that mineral's there, then you need to do this. Mm. Like, because people like me would actually have to tell them to do that. So I think there'll always be a place for, what do you call it, SAR, like subject matter experts, I guess. But the more, like in a processing plant, there's a lot of things that you could automate, and the AI, well, we talk about digital twins of processing facilities. So you could be running your processing plant from Sydney and, you know, the AI system could do most of it, but you'd always need to have people on the ground because, you know, the ChatGPT can't go out and fix your pump when it's broken, can it?
And that was Bianca Newcombe, a metallurgist who's based in Orange, speaking there with Tim Fuchs.
Keeping you updated every day, the Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen.
Now, the Tasmanian Merino Weather Challenge is underway in Campbelltown in the Northern Midlands, and kids from schools across the state have descended on the Campbelltown showgrounds to celebrate the end of this fantastic program. They've been working with their own couple of sheep over the past two terms. Joining me on the line is Lockie West, one of the organisers of today's event, and Judge Georgie Wallace. Good afternoon to you both.
Hi, Fiona. Thanks for having us on.
Good afternoon, Fiona.
I'll start off with Lockie. Thanks for joining us. It's a bit tricky managing this, but thank you for both getting on at the same time. Lockie, just wanted to check, these are high school children, are they?
Yep, they're high school kids from across the state. We have kids from schools as far down as Tasman and as far up as Sheffield. We have approximately 80 students and teachers that have attended the event today. And it's the conclusion of a two-term project they've had where farmers from across the state have donated six sheep to each of the schools, and the kids have looked after those sheep for the two-term period. And this is the final for them all to have a friendly competition to see how they've went.
So just before we get on to what happened in today's events or what is happening at the moment, first off, so farmers obviously had a bit of buy-in with this program. If you had them sort of donating the sheep for the kids to look after, they obviously thought it was worthwhile.
Oh, definitely. And we've had many of those farmers have attended the event today and seen how things have went. And yeah, we've had excellent support from the farmers across the state for the program. They've been visiting the schools throughout the couple of terms, and yeah, it's been a fantastic experience for everyone, I think.
So, Lockie, what sorts of things have the kids been learning, or how they've been handling the sheep?
So they're learning sort of best practice on how to handle the sheep and the animal welfare aspects, and just the various different things that are associated with running stock. And that's what we come here today at the event. We have a carcass value competition, we have a wool value competition, and we also have a best presented group where our judges, one of which is Georgie, have assessing the sheep, yeah, based on their presentation.
Okay, Lockie West, one of the organisers, thanks for joining us on the Country Hour. I'm going to cross now to Georgie Wallace, who is one of the judges. Tell me, Georgie, what are you judging and how's it all looking?
Well, Fiona, we've been judging just for the evenness of the group, evenness of wool type, and evenness of conformation and structure. So, myself, Andrew Calvert, and Bruce Dunbabin have done. We were asked to go around and mentor the 13 schools that initially put their hand up for this challenge, which has been fantastic. I've really thoroughly enjoyed going around the schools and helping them prepare their sheep for this competition.
Oh, so you've been actually, the judges have actually been visiting the schools?
Yes, so we were asked to mentor the schools, so we've sort of divided the schools up between the three of us and gone around the state helping mentor the students, teaching them what's required to look after their sheep as far as nutrition, and a lot of them have been doing like worm egg counts and that sort of thing, and then also on how to halter train your sheep, how to get them ready for this competition. So we've put a lot of, you know, facts and figures around it all, so, and a bit of science, so that the students are all really learning about the whole process.
Are you finding that they're sort of getting interested in agriculture and see this as a possibility in the future at all?
Oh, my word. I think there's a great buzz here today. All the students are really enjoying it and enjoying being involved and participating. You know, we have a real shortage of young people coming into our industry. Whether it be in the shearing industry or farmhands, or you know, the job opportunities for young people in the agriculture industry are endless. So I think it's something that we really should, as wool growers and farmers, should be really encouraging. So it's great to see. I think it'll be much bigger next year when we run it again next year. So been a really worthwhile exercise.
And you've got a few, you'd be pretty happy with the quality of the sheep that you're looking at today and the handling by the kids?
Oh, yeah, amazing. When I first visited some of the schools, I mean, the sheep were pretty wild. They hadn't been handled much, so... you know, they've done a great job and they're all, you know, leading on halters today. They're all very quiet, calm and relaxed. And, yeah, no, the students have done a terrific job in looking after them. They're all in really good condition. And, yeah, so when they first arrived, they were body weighed and had fat scores taken, mid-side sample taken. Then they were judged on the mat, which is where we were involved. They're now being shorn, so they'll be given a dollar value for their fleece and they'll also be given a dollar value for their carcass. And so all those points will come together at the end for, you know, for the placings.
Okay, Georgie Wallace. Now, I believe there might be a student on the other line. If they're there, can they introduce themselves?
Right.
hello, I'm Michaela.
Michaela. Hi, Michaela. And what school are you from?
Campbelltown District High School.
All right. Okay. So what's your surname, Michaela?
Michaela Lockett. So Lockett.
Yeah, Michaela, how's it been going today? It's been pretty good fun getting together with all the other kids from around the state to do this.
Yeah, definitely. It's good to look at other people's sheep and see how they've looked after theirs and, yeah.
Well, you're from an area where there's lots of sheep around Campbelltown. Your team must be pretty good.
Yeah, we know each other on the team, which is good, and it's a close community, so which is really good.
Is there anything that you find tricky about what you have to do today?
Not really. I think the most tricky part, to be honest, was actually the shearing part of it, because you had to really get the sheep up there, and once they've sheared, they're a bit different. They act a bit different since they don't have their wool on them anymore.
Okay, so you have to have them pretty well halter trained then to be able to handle them.
Yeah, definitely.
And they're pretty strong, aren't they?
Yeah, you have to hold on to them quite good.
Yeah. Well, look, thank you for joining us on the Country Hour and good luck in the competition today. And I hope you all have a great day.
Thank you.
Are you ready for the fire season ahead?
Mornings with Leon Compton.
On Tuesday, the Mornings program will be broadcasting to you from the main street in Chiefston. Only 4 years ago, it was a community threatened by fire.
They could become under threat, so that's why we've put the alert out.
So what have the locals learnt and how are they preparing for fire season this summer?
We're cutting my trees down a little bit and making sure everything's tidy.
Leon Compton.
Tuesday, Mornings from Chiefston.
On ABC Radio Hobart.
New research is digging into the effects of heat on bees. Heat stress on hives is likely to become a major factor as El Nino brings more days of soaring temperatures. Dr. Ross Glowick is a research fellow at the University of Sydney's Bee Lab who told Karen Hunt the subtle effects of heat on bees is not well understood.
What we know is that bees have a kind of upper thermal limit that they can tolerate, so kind of like maximum heat, after which their body systems shut down and the bee will die. And so there has been some work kind of understanding, well, what are those really like kind of extreme limits that they can tolerate? But then, of course, as always, things are a little bit more complicated than that if we want to understand how bees kind of respond out in the environment, in their natural lives when there's a heat wave. Because in that case, it's not just about what's the temperature at which the bee like physically drops dead, but, you know, what temperature does it stop foraging? What temperature, you know, does it lose fertility? Some of those more subtle impacts, and those are not so well understood.
The issue of fertility, I guess, would be one that is uppermost in breeders' minds. What's known about that?
This has been quite well studied in other insects. Certainly male fertility, so just kind of the function of sperm, drops off as you get to higher temperatures or kind of temperatures beyond what is normal for that species. And it can drop off quite sharply. Fertility for female bees or other insects, again, not as well understood, but is very likely also to have effects And, you know, the specific temperature at which fertility declines is going to vary between species. Species which have kind of adapted to hot, dry environments or whatever, which is the case for some Australian bees, they might be more tolerant of a heat wave than a species that's living in a cooler environment and adapted to an area where it conventionally hasn't had a lot of heat waves.
Given that we are heading into El Nino conditions, and also given that bees are such important pollinators for food for human consumption, is this raising alarm bells amongst the research and beekeeping industries?
I would say yes. Yep. It's definitely a topic that people are aware we really need to get a better grasp of, and quickly. We know we're heading into a future which is not just a kind of gradual increase in sort of mean temperature, but of course also just this increasing frequency of these extreme heat events. Hopefully we're heading towards a future where we do understand a little bit more about that, and also how to kind of mitigate that issue.
And that was Dr. Roz Gloag from the University of Sydney. Now it's time for the Livestock Report and Richard Bailey. Good afternoon, Richard.
G'day, Fiona. How are you going?
Good, good. We had a story earlier in the program about a crisis meeting about mutton markets crashing to their lowest levels in 16 years, with the national indicator falling below 100 cents per kilo. That's not new news for you, I'm assuming.
We've had a lot of sheep over the last few weeks that have been under 100 cents, I'll tell you. No, unfortunately, it's not. I'm really not quite sure what the real reasons or answers are, really. You know, like we're selling record amounts of mutton overseas, but, you know,
yeah,
I think...
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I would have thought it maybe exports were down.
No, the other way around. And and you'd have to think that it's got to do with kill space. Yep. But you'll need to talk to someone a bit more expert than me.
Yes, fair enough. Well, how are the markets around the place?
Similar number of cattle yesterday, small numbers, bit better quality of yearling cattle, and as a result, butchers are able to buy a few cattle there. They paid anywhere from 180 to 270 cents per yearling steers, most sort of 220 to 270, and heifers 190 to 258 cents a kilo. There were some good quality grown steers, and butchers hopped in here. They paid 240 to 268 cents a kilo, while a few heavy cows made 170 to 194 cents a kilo. That's cheaper than last week, but I'll tell you, it's better than most of the mainland markets were this week.
Okay.
Now, listen, before we go, we've got a big cattle sale tomorrow, a store sale. Looks like there'll be just shy of 3,000 cattle all up.
Wow.
I reckon if you want to buy cattle, it's a good place. There'll be a fair variety, but there'll be good lines and there'll be some crossies too. So good place to go.
And that's at Piranha?
That's at Piranha, 11 o'clock start.
Okay, what about sheep, mutton and lamb?
Very small yarding of 170 mutton, so really not enough to quote. There are only 522 lambs. There were some new season's lambs for the first time. They topped the top pen, made $110 a head, and the rest of them were bought by restockers from $40 to $82 a head. The old season's lambs, the tops of them were a little bit dearer, but everything else was cheaper. It meant that your heavy lambs were $116 to $121. Trade lambs 90 to 110, and then light trade making between $50 and $80 a head. Most of these will end up in the Middle East market. And as I said, not enough mutton to quote.
Okay, all right. So big, what am I trying to say? Piranha, big day at Piranha. Was it
tomorrow?
Thursday? Tomorrow. Yes,
yep, tomorrow. Really good opportunity for anyone looking for cattle. I don't know whether these numbers are going to continue for very long. We've had some big numbers over the last three sales, so... Good place to go, I reckon, if you're looking for cattle.
All right, Richard Bailey, we'll catch up with you again on Friday.
Good on you, Fiona.
Now, make sure you join us tomorrow on the Rural Reports in the early morning and on the Country Hour in the afternoon. We're going to talk asparagus tomorrow, white asparagus. We're also going to talk to some young women shearers who've been shearing for a couple of years and talk about how they're going, really enjoying the industry by the sounds of it. And I'm hoping also to catch up with some pear farmers. Pears aren't getting great prices in the last couple of seasons, and some people are rethinking their future in pairs. Now, if you get a chance, make sure you log into the ABC Rural online page. We've got a few stories on that drought forum up in Rockhampton in Queensland. They're talking about how prepared is Australia for the next big dry, what can we learn or what did we learn from the last drought. We're about to find out. There's also a few stories on beef. The Victorian Farmers Federation going through a little bit of turmoil as dairy leaders leave for a new lobby group. A bit of politics going on there. Some big fines for fishers in Queensland. Fishers that are ignoring fishing bans at endangered cod breeding sites. And a court order halts Victorian forest logging in the Western Victorian forest. So have a look at our online page and I'll catch you again at lunchtime tomorrow.